Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary Bitterman, Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, President of the Bernard Osher Foundation, and your moderator for this program. In fact, this program of the Commonwealth Club is part of its Good Literature series, which is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Do not think of that as a complication. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Philippa Gregory. It seemed to me most apparent that Dr. Gregory is a remarkable woman who writes about remarkable women. We're delighted to welcome you, Dr. Gregory, to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and far beyond via distribution of this program on public radio and the internet. Born in Kenya but moving to England when she was 2 years old, Miss Gregory attended the University of Sussex, worked for BBC Radio, became a PhD recipient in 17th century literature at the University of Edinburgh, and received its Alumna of the Year Award in 2009. Dr. Gregory has taught at several universities and was made a fellow of Kingston University in 1994. Dr. Gregory, as many of you know, is a prolific author, and I know that many in this room have read all of her books. She has published an array of works, including short stories and children's books, as well as her award-winning historical novels, several of which have been adapted for presentation on television. Of special interest in this evening's conversation is her work on the Cousins War, with the novels The White Queen, The Red Queen, and the just-published The Lady of the Rivers, the story of Jaquetta of Luxembourg. Together with fellow historians David Baldwin and Michael Jones, she's published what we might call a companion nonfiction piece, The Women of the Cousins War. In the book's introduction, Dr. Gregory discusses the difference between writing history and writing historical fiction, why her protagonists are absent from or seldom mentioned in the historical record, and the shortage of women historians until recent days. If this were not enough, and in addition to her writing, Dr. Gregory is also a philanthropist, having founded Gardens for the Gambia nearly 20 years ago. She was there while doing research for another book. She has subsequently raised funds to dig almost 200 low-technology, easily maintained wells, which are on stream and providing water to irrigate school and community gardens. Miss Gregory lives with her family on a small farm in Yorkshire where she keeps horses, hens, and ducks. So you can see we have a Renaissance woman right here. Ladies and gentlemen, let us warmly welcome Dr. Philippa Gregory to the Commonwealth Club of California. I know that we're going to have many questions from the audience. I could just see as people were lined up coming into meeting room that there was a great deal of conversation. So I'm going to start with just a few as you write down your own questions, and then I will defer to your questions as we go forward. I think one of the most interesting subjects on which you have extraordinary experience to comment is a question that I know has been raised with you before, but I think both for our audience here and for the large audiences on radio and internet, if you would comment on history and historical fiction. Fact, how much fact, how much fiction, and how you sort of bring this all together in a way which maintains the integrity of an historical record, but gives you a bit of room in which to move, and especially to raise characters like some of these extraordinary women who really haven't been well touched before.
I think there isn't a right and a wrong answer to it. I think there's, in a sense, there's every author comes to the historical record in their own way with their own particular bias, either for more or for less history. At the far end of the spectrum, the books that I would describe as frankly nonsensical would be those that basically use the historical background as an excuse for really pretty clothes and rather eccentric behaviour. And there is nothing there which is fundamentally historical at all. So the authors write what may very well be a modern story, possibly even a modern love story with modern morality, but put the girls in nice dresses, and that's really all they're doing. At the other extreme of it, actually, you come to things which people offer as history. So, for instance, Antonia Fraser's popular histories seem to me to be very much towards the reconstruction, the fictional reconstruction of a researched past, which seems to me, although it's offered as popular history, goes a long way to being something which I would regard as a fictional construction. Towards that end, more history than fiction, I would think, is where I sit pretty well, which is that I always base the unfolding narrative on the historical record. So any principal events in the character's life are going to be there in the historical record. There's not going to be a major event which is not on the historical record. I don't make up good bits for the benefit of the fiction. But having got the historical record clear and got, as it were, a timeline which forms the narrative, the fiction then works in that it has to deliver the emotion, which the historical record of these years never gives you. You hardly ever get what anybody's feeling. And it has to deliver things that also you would never get any other way, which is, in a sense, the conversation, the dialogue, the psychology, the inner life, the sort of things that novels have to have if they're to be novels at all. So there's a kind of very... there's a double craft which goes on in each book. One is the craft of the historian, the research, the establishment of the facts as we know them, and the establishment of the facts as we speculate about them. One of the things that's concealed when people make the contrast between history and fiction is how much of history is itself made up by the historian. So we know, for instance, Anne and Henry VIII quarrel so extremely that in the end he decides that he would rather kill her than negotiate a settlement with her. You'd hardly anywhere read the fact that they do negotiate a settlement in which she is to be released, which she signs up to, and which she thinks he will adhere to. Mm-hmm. Historians don't bother telling you that very much, because what's much more important is that he doesn't adhere to it, so she ends up dead. So from the historian's point of view, that's the important fact. From the novelist's point of view, the interweaving of that, the fact that there is an agreement which totally altered her view of what would happen next, which would totally altered her view of what would happen to her daughter, all her family would have expected her to be released. That's an incredibly interesting, rich historical fact, which isn't interesting to historians, but it's incredibly important for a novelist.
So we have to do something to improve the lifestyle of historians. I mean... It's concerning.
Not really, because it's because
I mean,
it's a different
craft.
It just
makes them sound, yeah.
It's what they're interested in. They're interested in what happened. That's their job. As a novelist, you're interested in all the possibilities. That's your job. It's a different job.
And you know, historians have given names to things, which I think you have an interesting way of bringing some new names as well. And it's the focus on the Cousins' War.
Yeah. Well... this is the war which was between the houses of York and Lancaster. It originally was between the brothers, who were the sons of Edward III, who were the Duke of York and the Duke of Lancaster. When they came to war, it was their sons, so therefore it was the cousins. At the time, if you asked someone living in England at the time what's going on, they would say, oh, well, the cousins' war is what's happening. Interestingly, what then happens is that Shakespeare, who is such a nuisance, I have to say, I mean, that's like kind of blasphemy, but Shakespeare is such a nuisance in this period because he bases his fantastic cycle of history plays on mostly on the Chronicles of Holinshed, which is a little bit older than him, mm-hmm. which is based on not particularly very good history, rather more historical fiction than history. Then you have Shakespeare dramatizing and fictionalizing on top of that. And so Shakespeare writes this wonderful scene in the garden of the Inns of Court, London, where the Duke of Lancaster plucks a red rose, which will be his emblem, right. And the Duke of York plucks a white rose, which will be his emblem. And thereafter, Victorian painters paint this lovely picture of these two men facing off in the garden, plucking their roses. None of this happened. just didn't happen. So subsequently, the Victorians, particularly Walter Scott, calls it the Wars of the Roses, which is a great title for a war. Nonsense, really. It's absolutely true that the House of York used a white rose as one of their badges, and used it quite frequently. But their principal badge was the Sun in Splendor. The House of Lancaster did use a red badge amongst other badges. So they did have different, you know, there's that grain of truth which you normally find in the bottom of most myths. But the War of the Roses is entirely a modern invention.
While we're really focusing a bit more this evening on the third volume, I wondered if you wanted to say something about your two earlier books that carry the words red and white. The Queens.
Well, the first book I came to was one which was just of enormous interest to me, and it's based on the story of Elizabeth Woodville. And she is a little bit known to some people as the girl who was the commoner who attracted the interest of Edward IV, and he married her in secret without the knowledge of his court, and then had this really embarrassing moment when they were planning his marriage, his official marriage, to the Princess Bona of Savoy, which would have been a great European alliance. And he had the difficult task to say to the Earl of Warwick, who was a hard man to disagree with, he had to say to him, I'm sorry, I'm married already, which was just hugely shocking. She's a commoner, so she's of interest to us, really, because she's probably the first commoner ever to marry into the royal family. It's a very, very unusual thing to happen. At the time, they say it's a consequence of the king's lust. Later on, they would actually say it was a consequence of witchcraft, that her mother had enchanted him and forced him and her daughter into marriage. Later on, they would extend the charge of witchcraft to her. So it's such an unusual, provocative thing to have happened. And I got tremendously interested in this woman who comes from nowhere and ends up being a very good wife to Edward IV through some very, very dangerous times for them. He goes into exile during her marriage and she has to go into sanctuary. And on his death, she has to hide in sanctuary again from Richard III. And it is her two sons who end up disappearing into the Tower of London, and we don't know what happened to them. So it's an extraordinary life that she lives. I called her the White Queen because she is the queen of the House of the White Rose of York. And then I naturally called her great rival, Margaret Beaufort, the Red Queen. And this is the mother of Henry Tudor, who ultimately becomes Henry VII, when after a lifetime in exile where his mother never stops plotting and manipulating and, in one occasion, actually organising a fully-fledged, fully-military rebellion against him, she's then put under house arrest by her own husband, forbidden access to anybody, and she still goes on plotting the return of her son, which finally succeeds at the Battle of Bosworth when he comes in and kills Richard III.
And what a few words, because I know many people are going to obtain your books this evening. If you would just say a few words about this incredible Lady Jacquetta.
Jacquetta is the... She's this wonderful character. Actually, I'm tremendously fond of her because the last book is always your new baby. You know, and you always say to your children, I love you all the same.
Yes.
You know, you don't, of course. You love the new one most because it's just arrived. So I love Jacquetta, Duchess of Bedford, very much indeed. And she's born in... She's quite unlike anyone I've ever worked with before. She's born into the House of Luxembourg. So she's European royalty, which is a very different family, a very different feel about them. And she lives her life in the great chateaus of France. And she may well have been staying with her uncle, who is John of Luxembourg, when he arrested and brought in Joan of Arc. So she's right at the centre of the Hundred Years' War in France. And so she actually marries John, Duke of Bedford, who burns Joan of Arc at the stake as a witch. So from that very first moment in the novel, it's possible for me, in a sense, to give the sense to the reader that we're going to be talking about someone who is at the centre of events, someone who is powerless in the centre of events, as all women were at that time, and someone who has a very powerful demonstration of the danger that there is for women if they step outside the traditional role of power behind the throne, if they try and take control of events and make a difference themselves, then they will face, you know, the most severe charges that a woman can face, usually witchcraft. And Jacqueline Bede is accused later in her life of bringing about the marriage of her daughter, Elizabeth Woodville, and the King of England by witchcraft. And she faces a full trial, and she's found guilty at that trial. And it's only the Earl of Warwick who decides, we don't even know why, not to proceed with the sentence. He releases her, and she goes into sanctuary with her daughter. And so she's released from sanctuary with her daughter when her son-in-law, the King of England, comes back to England. But she lives an extraordinary, I mean, she has a long life, apart from anything else. She has 16 confinements with no anaesthesia and no medical assistance. And she survives all of that and actually survives long enough to see her daughter secure on the throne of England.
One of the questions, and we'll see what the answer will be, if there's one of your characters with whom you could have dinner.
Mm. It's always an interesting question, isn't it? Because you don't want anybody too grim at dinner. You want someone who's going to be good company. So Margaret Beaufort, definitely not. She's the most really serious, very determined. I mean, in my novel, she is, I think, quite entertaining. But that's because I invite the reader to kind of lovingly laugh at her. I mean, she's an absolutely determined woman. You wouldn't want to quarrel with her. You wouldn't want dinner with her. Elizabeth Woodville would be great company. I'm very fond of Catherine of Aragon. I wrote about her in a book called The Constant Princess. Mm-hmm. And again, she's one of these characters that history doesn't do very well by her, because as historians, we're so focused on the fact that she will be supplanted by a younger wife, that her time, as it were, in the sunshine of the king's approval and her time of happiness is 16 years. It's only 16 years. But actually, she lasts longer of any of the wives. So in many ways, I think we read her wrongly, because we know that she's going to end alone and lonely and separated from her daughter and in a sense defeated by Anne Boleyn. In a sense, her story is always read bearing that in mind. But actually, as a young woman, when she comes to England and challenges Henry VII to hold to his treaty, to his agreement with her, and perform her second marriage to Henry VIII, and then she just sticks it out with the most incredible courage and stubbornness. And then finally, when the old king dies and the young king, Henry VIII, comes to the throne as an 18-year-old, he just sweeps her up. It's the first thing he does. He marries her. And it's an intensely romantic, I think exciting, relationship. Which was a very happy one for him, probably the best wife he ever had. And I liked it that in my novel I didn't go through to her death. I actually stopped it at the moment of her greatest triumph, when she is made regent of England and she repels an attack by the Scots and her army kills the King of Scots. And it's one of the most major victories in English history, and she's the first regent of England.
So she would be your dinner companion.
She's my dinner guest.
Okay, that's lovely. There's the curiosity, especially since you are involved with history and historical fiction. Do you rely more on secondary or on primary source material?
I absolutely have to rely on both. Of course, there's an enormous amount of secondary material, and when you come particularly to the Tudors, you know, you would suffocate under the avalanche of histories of the Tudors. There's a real advantage in that for me, that some of the best work that's been done on them has been done by Victorian historians, and they did a lot of the translation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the primary material is in Latin or sometimes Old French, and I couldn't read that, I couldn't work from that directly. So I'm bound to use republished material. And then a lot of some very interesting work has been done in modern times. In a sense, the work that I'm doing, recovering some of these characters. So family histories, you know, have become really very interesting. And social histories are very interesting in terms of, like, what's growing in the fields, what the weather's like, medicine, of course, the attitude to women. Those histories are all new, and those are published now. They simply
It's very interesting in some of your work when you bring out the household books, you know, and how registers are kept and the rest of it. It just gives such an interesting nuance to life in the times. Several of your books have been adapted for television. Were you pleased with the adaptations?
Never. Oh. I don't think.
I think this is often the answer to this question of authors.
I think it's so, you know, if you're a book person, then you're always going to like the book best. And so, you know, I find with other books, you know, even with really famous films like, you know, something like Rebecca, you know, or Gone with the Wind, you know, fantastically successful films, almost perfect as a film could be, but actually I'd prefer to read the fiction. And that's, of course, it's ever so much truer when it's your own book. Of course you're going to like that better than anything anyone else is going to do. I think there's a big difficulty, which is that, you know, any sensible author understands that if you have, you know, a massive, massive business, like a Hollywood film project takes over your script, it's not going to be a process in which you are going to be the person who calls the shots. You know, the film, The Other Boleyn Girl, I think cost something like £72 million to make. Now, they're not going to change a scene that they've got all ready to shoot because I'm not happy with the fact that they've got a bouquet in the scene before people use flowers in bouquets. They're just not. And so that sort of worry is utterly irrelevant, really, to the business of making a great film. And when you see it up on screen and the actors' performances have come together and this magnificent costume, landscape, this extraordinary work of art is there and it's all working together, I think it makes sense that you don't sit there going, like, they didn't have carriages. You know, they didn't have carriages. There she is in a carriage. They didn't have carriages. Of course, that's what I'm doing. I can't help that because I'm footnoting every single thing that ever happens. But I think for the viewer, you get an overall impression, which is what the movie's really good at. What I happen to be obsessed with is a historical detail. So, of course, it's always going to be a compromise with me when stuff gets on screen. And some better than others, I have to say.
There's just really some lovely questions. I'm going to make sure you receive all of them because we may not have an opportunity to raise each in our discussion. But someone remarks that it's apparent that your books are so well researched. After doing such large amounts of research, why have you decided to write fiction and not nonfiction, especially about such fascinating periods in British history?
Well, the perfect answer to this question is I have now written a non-fiction. I've now written a history book. And the reason that I wrote and published this historical essay on Jacquetta, Duchess of Bedford, was because nothing else was available. I wouldn't write you a history of Henry VIII because there are so very many histories of Henry VIII already. If you want to read a good history of Henry VIII, you have a massive choice. I would only be really offering my interpretation of events and my particular prejudice to the record. In the case of Jacquetta, Duchess of Bedford, when I came to research her, there was simply nothing published, not even an essay. Nobody had written on her at all. So I had to do all the original research and find out where she was, in a sense, hunt for her through the history. And when I couldn't write the novel until I had all of that material. And when I was then about to start the novel, it seemed to me that since I had done all this research, it was a pity not to publish it, because I knew that I would have readers who would say to me, what's the true story? What's the story behind the fiction? And I couldn't direct them to anything. Whereas if anybody asked me about Anne Boleyn, again, dozens, scores of books. So I wrote an essay on Jacquetta, and that's what I published with David Baldwin and Michael Jones in the Women of the Cousins War, which is a companion history book to the novels. And it was important to publish those two authors, jointly with those two authors, because although David Baldwin is an acknowledged expert on Elizabeth Woodville and Michael Jones an acknowledged expert on Margaret Beaufort, both of their books had fallen out of print, so you couldn't readily get them, whereas now at least you get an essay from both of them.
It's a very congenial pairing. It really, I think, is very helpful, and I would certainly recommend to readers that they look at the two because they're very nice.
I mean, I wouldn't ever disagree with someone trying to sell my book, so yes, buy both, buy lots, buy some for Christmas. But in a way, the novel has to just be a novel. You are really allowed to read it on the sun lounger, forget every word you've read and leave it at the resort. It's got to be absolutely a standalone fiction form. And one of the things I really like about the books is, although I know that a lot of people have studied history as a result of reading my fictions or gone on to take an interest in history. It at the heart of it, it's, for me, it's got to be a good novel. It can't be an introduction to a history study.
Good. People want to know now if you've ever considered doing American historical novels dealing with the American character.
Yes, I think it's always tricky if you leave your own culture. You know, you never exactly know what you know, and you always know far more about your own life and your own times and your own culture than you really realize you do. And I think if you step into someone else's culture, you're likely to make accidentally tremendous howlers. So I'm always rather anxious about that, but I'm very interested in particularly the stories of early America, and I wrote a book called Virgin Earth, which is about a gardener, John Tredescant, who came to Virginia and sent back to England a fantastic collection of plants. Almost all of the American plants that we grow in our gardens now were first discovered here and sent to England by John Tredescant. And I really loved writing about him, and I really loved... He spent some time with the Powhatan people, now known as the Pamunkey people. Just a fascinating story. And his on the historical record, actually, Captain John Smith visited their home, and John Tredescant collected the Chief Pocahontas' war cloak. And he founded a museum which was called then the Tradescantian Museum and was stolen from him by, and is now the Bodleian Museum, Ashmolean collection. Sure. And you can see these fantastic early American artifacts actually in Oxford, and they were brought there by John Tredescant, whose story I told in Virgin Earth. So that's as close as I've got to your... I have a great anxiety of, in a sense, trying to study in a very different culture.
Mm-hmm. Of course, people are always eager to know what your next project is going to be.
Well, it's in its first draft, so it's on the way. It's going to be the story of Anne Neville, again, a woman of extraordinary interest who had an extraordinary life and is in the history absolutely as someone's plus one. You know, so you first of all meet her and she's Earl of Warwick's daughter. He was called the Kingmaker. So she was absolutely present when the Court of York was first turned into a royal court, and her father is the person who made that possible. That's why they called him the Kingmaker. He then turns against the Court of York, and she finds herself in exile in France and married off with incredible speed and lack of romance to Prince Edward of Lancaster. And so she should then be the next Queen of England, Queen Anne of Lancaster, except for the fact that when they land to invade, and she is with the invading army, as a very young woman, just a girl, her husband is killed in the Battle of Tewkesbury. And she then finds herself absolutely lost. Her father has already died at one battle. Her young husband has died at another battle. Her mother dives into sanctuary and won't come out for fear of being executed for treason. And she's quite alone in the world, and she goes into the keeping of her sister, who is married to a Duke of the House of York. So she's back in the hands of York again. And then the great mystery is from that position, she ends up married to a Duke of York, Richard, who will ultimately be Richard III. So she does end up being Queen of England. This, I mean, what's wrong with that in terms of a fantastic life? There's hardly a biography about her. There's a very small biography written by a modern English historian in which he says he thought it would be impossible to write the biography because there was so little known about her. It's incredible to me that a woman should live such a life and yet leave such a small mark on the historical record. So yet again, I'm reconstructing her history and writing a novel about her.
Do you go to universities, and where I know you speak very often, encouraging women to get into the field of history?
No, I think I just live my life and that encourages women to get into the field of history. I mean, of course, I'm very much in favour of scholarship. I know I'm an academic addict. I'm very much in favour of scholarship, and particularly for women, yes, particularly for young women.
Yes, in our discussion before coming in, we were talking about the dearth of women historians in earlier years, and there was a very distinguished British historian, C.V. Wedgwood, who wrote on the 30 Years' War, and it was always fun when people would say, well, he was such a great person, and then one would want to remind the commentator that CV stood for Sicily Veronica Wedgwood. Do you have assistants or researchers working with you? Do you have a cast of thousands helping you cull these historical records?
No. I don't have anyone who does any research for me, and there's a good reason for that. But when I was studying, I knew I wanted to write a book about the Tudor Navy. And so I was in a library in London looking up documents about the Tudor Navy and what people were writing about. I was pretty sure that there was a female pirate in the Tudor period, and I was rather interested in a woman who would take that as an occupation. And while I was looking for documents about it, I came across the account of a launching of a ship, and the ship was called Mary Boleyn. And in the library, I went, that's odd. That doesn't ring a bell with me. Surely it should be Anne, or perhaps her mother, Elizabeth. Who is this Mary Boleyn? Looked up in footnotes, discovered that there was indeed a Mary Boleyn, that she was the mistress of Henry VIII, that she was in confinement having his baby, which would turn out to be a son, which would turn out to be a Henry. When her sister arrived in court, everybody fell in love with Anne, and Henry left Mary for Anne, and Anne became Queen of England, and Mary had to serve as her lady-in-waiting to her sister and her former lover. And I went, that's such a great story. Isn't that a story about sibling rivalry, and how irritating would that be if you were Mary? You know, would you ever forgive your sister for behaving in such a way? I mean, the fury of any normal woman in these circumstances just seemed to me extraordinary. And I found her when I was looking, actually, for documents about the Tudor Navy. If I had employed a bright, shiny researcher and told him or her to go and find me documents about the Tudor Navy, they would have brought me back a nice file of documents about the Tudor Navy, and they would never have mentioned Mary Boleyn, because it wasn't what I'd asked for. So one of the interesting things, the great joy of history, is you always find things that you aren't looking for, and very often you don't find things you are looking for, but that's the price you pay for these extraordinary insights that come now and then.
Members of the audience have interest in the Restoration period. Is that a period with some of its interesting characters that might find their way in novels of yours?
It's like Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, isn't it? You know, somebody here is interested in the Restoration. Well, they can be.
The question is, does it have any interest to you?
Not a lot, because I'm not much in favour of a monarchy. So I see the Restoration as a real mistake, a really terrible mistake from which we've still not recovered.
So May 29th, 1660 would be a very bad day.
Disaster.
In your calendar.
Very bad day. Very bad day for the liberty of England. Actually, I truly believe it. And, you know, a bad day for anyone who isn't, you know, a raving snob, because what we did then was restore a monarchy that has gone on being the pinnacle of a very stratified, structured, snobbish society, which... What it does for us in terms of nice pageants and trooping of the colour, I think we pay for overly much. So, but having said that, Charles II is utterly gorgeous, I agree. You couldn't help but love him. And his mistresses and his wife and his court and his general folderol and nonsense, very, very delightful. But not a good day in political history from my point of view.
That's what I did my dissertation on. And it's so funny because Charles II was born on May 29th, which is my birthday, and then restored on his birthday. No, but I can understand how one would have a very different point of view.
I've just got that kind of feeling, you know, at a dinner party where you've just said something utterly dreadful, like, I'm allergic to fish, and then you find that everything thereafter is going to be fishy.
Fish.
Like,
exactly.
Okay.
No,
all
no.
Right.
So then this question.
Moving on.
Moving on, but this is very interesting, and now I really must raise it, even though I know there may be some sensitivity, but we're all friends here.
We were.
No, we definitely are. Two questions actually relate to the current dynasty, and wondering whether or not the Windsors provide material for you as you look forward.
I think the Queen is Really, she's obviously been a fantastic monarch. She's done a remarkable job. She's obviously going to go on doing it till death, which is what actually I would expect a monarch to do. I think the people who think that she might leave as if she's like, I don't know, working in a dry cleaning store. It's not like that. It's not a job like that. You do it forever. And she's been fantastic. Also, she's been queen all my life, so I've never sung God Save the King. Actually, I don't sing God Save the Queen now either, but she wouldn't mind. I'm absolutely certain that does not represent any kind of threat to the dynasty. I'm not particularly interested in them now because really since the Victorians, they have converted themselves as a family into, in a sense, the encapsulation of bourgeois middle-class values. And so most of the material that you read about them, most of the interest in them is either that they are encapsulating middle-class values, a marriage for love, a fairy tale wedding, nicely behaved children, or they're rebelling against them, falling out of nightclubs, drunk, seeing unsuitable girls, I believe an American, with a tattoo. I'm not interested. Really, I don't care less. If we're going to have immorality, let's have it on the massive scale of, that Henry VIII does or Edward IV does. If we're going to have eccentric behavior, let's have it like Henry VI and fall asleep for 18 months.
Yes.
This wishy-washy, slightly bad behavior is of absolutely no interest to me whatsoever, except as gossip. And I really don't want my taxpayers' money to be spent on financing people to be slightly misbehaving. My kids do that, and it costs me just as much.
Let me just remind our audiences on the electronic media that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is the acclaimed British historian and novelist, Dr. Philippa Gregory. Continuing interest in the way you approach your subjects. And one questioner raises the issue of you have focused on women, and we know that there's been a dearth of women historians, and this is a very good thing, but can you imagine writing some novels from a man's point of view?
I have written novels from the male point of view. The ones I mentioned about John Tredescant, Virgin Earth and Earthly Joys, were written from the point of view of father and son, both gardening actually in your period. Very interesting period, I must say. I think, personally, the older I get, the stranger men seem to me. I am married, and I am the mother of sons, stepmother to two sons. They are quite different from girls. Men are utterly different, it seems to me, from women. I often think that I have more in common and have a greater sense of kinship with a woman 600 years ago than I do with a modern man. And, how does this represent itself? Do you not think that they have some kind of ration system for words? So they only have like 1,000 words they can say in a day. And what they must not do is use them all up at breakfast. Which is why you have this long conversation. You will say, I'm going to do that, then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do that. And then I thought we might do this together, and then I quite like to do that. How do you feel about that? He says, fine. And you go, 999 left then. Well, let's not break into them at this point. I do think men are quite odd, actually, from the female sensibility. And I like men. I enjoy their company, and, they have fantastic abilities as well. I do think I drive just as good as a man. And why it seems to me that when I'm about to park my car, I've been driving for decades. And whenever I'm going to back into a parking space, from nowhere, a totally strange man appears and waves you back. And you go like, it's okay. I know how to do this. I've been doing this. I don't know. I don't understand them. I find them extraordinary. I can write about them, and I can write of them with some confidence. But when I get stuck, I will go and see my husband and say to him, if you were married to a woman who was incapable of giving you a son, and you're really keen on founding a dynasty, and you're really, really in love with a woman who was proclaimed a virgin, would you be her lover in real form? And he says, not now. So I do have help in that sense.
No. And nearby. That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. You know, to be such a prolific author, how do you go about your day? Do you bring a certain discipline to the day, that certain times are set apart for writing, or when the mood
I've stolen this line from Lee Child. I was doing an event with him, and he said to an American audience, "I'm a European. We have no work ethic." So I start the day fairly joyfully, and I do really what I feel like doing, and sometime during the day, without fail, I will feel like writing. And just as you might be reading a book that you really can't wait to get back to, that you want to read it, for me it's a very similar process in the writing process, particularly when it's going well. And I'm blessed with the fact that very often it's going well. So I just naturally find myself going to the study and starting writing during the day. And then in the evening, I work on a laptop. So in the evening, very often after dinner, I'll sit on the sofa and write. And we have this very amicable marriage whereby my husband, especially in the English winter, will have the football, soccer, on the television. And he will watch this without disturbing me while I'm writing. So we have these kind of dual lives in which we're both pursuing our chief interest in the same room, in companionable silence. And it works very well.
If you were to have to spend some time in conversation, dinner, or whatever, with a member of the current royal family, would that be the Queen?
Well, I want her to do something, so yes, I would choose to see her at the moment. I do actually have friends in the current royal family, and they are aware of my opinions. that one of them, I said to her, I'd be delighted to meet her. She invited me for lunch. And I said, I'd be delighted to go for lunch, but I didn't feel I could take her hospitality because I don't believe in the existence of the royal family. Neither do most of us. Why don't you come anyway? What I would really like the Queen to do is to rule in the Privy Council that the people of the Chagos Islands should be returned to their homeland. The British government leased the Chagos Islands, which is a collection of islands in the Indian Ocean, to the Americans, to your government, in 1968 for a military base, and assured the Americans that the islands were uninhabited. Alas, when the British actually got there and were bothered to have a look, they discovered that there were 1,500 people on the island. They ordered them to leave. They herded their animals, their pet dogs, into the coconut plant factory, the calorifier, and they gassed them with the exhaust fumes of trucks. They then took the people with only what they stood up in and dumped them on the quaysides of the Seychelles and Mauritius, and they have paid them no compensation and given them no rights ever since. There's now about 4,000 of these people because this was 1968, so they've carried on marrying and having children, and they've never ceased to campaign for their return. They asked me to be their patron a year ago, and I have done what I can, which is distressingly little, to raise this with the British government. And one of the defences the British government has for doing nothing is that the Americans need sole occupancy of all of these islands, Diego Garcia and all of the other surrounding islands of the Chagos Atoll. I think it's tremendously important that British government confirm that the Americans really do need this empty. And if they do need it empty, that we as people say to them, no, you don't. The nearest island's 120 miles away. This is not a security risk to the servicemen on Diego Garcia. And it's really important that these people have the right to return to their homeland. It was utterly tyrannical, the way they were lifted up. And I'm not getting anywhere very fast at the moment. I find myself in the uncomfortable position of being actually in dispute, therefore, with the Pentagon, in dispute with my own government. And if I had dinner with the Queen, I would hope that she would, you know, she's a great supporter of the Commonwealth. You know, I know she feels very responsible about these people, and yet her government is currently abusing their human rights.
Say a little bit more, because we were talking about this in our conversation before coming on air. The number of people who were involved and how many are now in the UK, how many might still be in adjoining areas like Mauritius? And
there's about, initially, the first expulsion was about 1,500 people. And since then, there's now about, there's about that number, about 1,500 in the UK and about 2,500 in Mauritius and the Seychelles. So we're not talking about an enormous population. That means that really we should compensate them, and also it wouldn't be appallingly expensive. It means that we could create an eco-village, a green village, on one of the outer islands, and the people could serve as volunteers, as guardians of the coral reef, which is so precious in this environment round. And I cannot see why my government does not do the right thing. I'm mortified that we don't. And even now, there's a case going through the European Court of Human Rights by the Chagos people demanding the right to return, and my government is opposing that. My government is actually defending an offence against human rights. I'm baffled that we should behave so badly and that we should go on behaving so badly. You know, this was 1968, which seems to me very late in history to treat indigenous people as if you could just pick them up and shift them. To be carrying on that policy now in the 21st century. It's been, so if anybody knows a congressman or a senator, or if anybody has Hillary Clinton's phone number, I'm anxious to speak to them.
You know, just thinking of places beyond Britain, I was very interested, and I think our audience would be, in the work that you did in the Gambia, and how this philanthropy that you began is really continuing over several decades. As I recall it, you were in the Gambia doing some work on one of your books.
I was researching The Respectable Trade, which is a story about slavery in West Africa and in England. I mean, unusually, most people talk about slavery novels and talk about the transatlantic trade bringing slaves to the Americas. A substantial number of slaves were brought on to England, and their life as domestic slaves in England is very little recorded, partly because people observed it at the time, but it wasn't particularly noteworthy. There were a lot of black slaves in England. And also, subsequently, when it became such a shameful thing to have done, it's not something that if you find it in your family history, you write a great history about it. You tend to keep it quiet. So it was a very interesting novel to research, and I started in West Africa. And while I was there, I met a teacher in a small rural school who asked me, would I pay money for to put a well into his schoolyard. It's a tiny little building built of breeze blocks with a corrugated down roof. The children sat on the floors, the earth floors, for their lessons. They had no books, they had no stationery, they had no pens. The teacher taught them by standing in front and reciting the lesson, and the children were expected to learn this. At lunchtime, there was nothing to eat except rice, which was then provided by the World Health Organization, and they had to bring all the water for drinking through the day and for cooking in buckets on their heads from their homes in the village 2 or 3 miles away. So you'd see in the morning these very little children, children of four and upwards, carrying these big buckets of water. He asked me, would I put a well in the schoolyard? And I said, how much would that be? You know, it's so always uncomfortable when you're a wealthy person in a third world country. You go all the time, I really should be paying more for this or paying for this. So I said, how much would it be with that kind of, you know, compassion fatigue that one suffers? And he said, £300, to say about $400. And I thought, that's extraordinarily cheap to make so, potentially so much difference. So I gave him the money for the well, and when I got back to England after I'd finished my research trip, he sent me a fax. We faxed in those days. He sent me a fax. He said, we've dug the well, we've planted a garden, there's going to be vegetables for the children to eat at lunchtime, there's water for them to drink throughout the day. We've planted trees, and when they come on as a cash crop, we're going to sell the fruit and the nuts from the trees to raise money for the school, to buy books for the children so they can write, learn to write with pens and paper. He says, it's a fantastic project. We thank you very much. P.S. The school next door would be very pleased if you would bother the well in their garden. And I went, why not? This is just a really neat project. I raise the money, I give it to him. He's honest. He employs a well digger. We dig a well. The school takes it over. Job done. So my first one was in a school called Seeker, and now, as you say, we're heading up towards 200 wells. There's only 250 primary schools in the country, and it's my determination to put a well in every school before I die, and I'm going to make it. It's going to happen. And if you want to know more about it, you can go to my website, which is philippagregory.com, and there's a button on there, which is just about the charity. And we've grown old together. He's such a great man. He's now retired from the school. He's a headmaster. And he reached retirement age. He's 65. And so now he said to me, I'm full time now. Now we can really get going.
That's wonderful. That's just wonderful. Something that's of growing interest to people really all over the world is something that you're also developing there, and that's some beekeeping.
Well, we've diversified a bit. That what we found was once we established the gardens, not only could we teach people different gardening techniques, irrigation techniques, so they're not reliant on the rains, which is, of course, an increasing problem because it is getting drier.
It's a very arid area.
Sahara is fundamentally encroaching. So we're doing that. We do beekeeping. We do pottery making. We teach people sustainable agriculture. We're broadening out almost inevitably. And one of our wells went into a women's garden where this cooperative of women dug by hand around 8 acres, an earth wall. Can you imagine digging a perimeter wall around 8 acres using just really bowls, tin bowls and their hands? And then they flooded it and they planted the Gambia's first rice crop, which has been tremendously successful as a crop. And so we partnered with that rice crop area to do a feeding system into some of the poorer schools. So we're actually growing our own rice now. It's a little economy. It's a thriving little economy.
It's just wonderful. You mentioned that I think it was last year or the year before that as part of your speaking tours with your very long list of books that you were in South Africa. Did you have any opportunity when you were in South Africa to do things besides your book tour, to do some around? And
I had some blissfully enjoyable times looking at conservation projects and some of the game parks there. And I did a little work with some literacy projects as well. I mean, it's especially for girls in developing countries. I think if you educate women, then you secure the health of the children, you know, so that they can then read. So in the Gambia as well, we have, in most of the schools, we use some of the water from the well to pay for teachers, for evening classes for women. I think the education of women is central to the development of these third world countries.
Were there any of the women that you may have met that you thought of as material for novels?
No, I don't tend to find novels from life in that way. Now and then I'll meet someone and they'll say something that makes me think about perhaps, for instance, the whole concept of arranged marriages. So if I meet someone who's had an arranged marriage and it's been successful or unsuccessful, if they tell me something about it, it'll make me think about it. But I don't ever, in a sense, you know, even you are safe. You know, I don't hoover stuff up as I go along and go like, well, have you? You know, you'd be nice to that. Funnily enough, you would think people like that. But my sister, when my first novel was published, rang me up and she said, of course, I'm Lady Eleanor. And I went like, no, you're not. And she went, aren't I? And she was very disposed to be offended that she thought I had parodied her cruelly and put her in a novel. But when I explained that she was nowhere in it at all, she was immensely offended that she hadn't had more influence.
Oh, my goodness. When you did your own study at Edinburgh, what was your thesis topic?
It's the most boring title.
No, but that's
ever.
All right. Many of them are. But then they sometimes put a colon afterwards do a very long...
Yes. No, this was the popular fiction of the 18th century commercial circulating library, 1739 to 1801. So I assure you, the only book I've ever had which hasn't made it into the top 10. And I think it was the title.
and certainly not taken into a television format by the BBC.
It could have been. Well, it was quite interesting. It was very interesting to do. It was basically a study of the novels that people were reading in the 18th century, looking at the library stocks because people didn't buy books so much as borrow them then. And then I read 150 of the most popular novels, and then I broke them down into a computer program to see what were the, like, dominant themes, thinking that one might be able to extrapolate from that as to what did the 18th century people think mm-hmm. and feel about mm-hmm. things. Because fundamentally I wanted to answer the question, why are women in the Gothic novels so incredibly stupid? Is it a literary device in order to have a villain and in order to have some drama, in order to have a suffering victim? Or is it actually that 18th century women were incredibly stupid and if warned not to go out after midnight because there was a werewolf in the village, would immediately see the moon shining and go like, what a lovely night, I think I'll have a stroll. which is an absolute dominant theme of all of these novels, that these women, you know, walk into danger having been cautioned not to. And, of course, a continuing theme in many ways of where popular fiction describes women. So I thought it'd be very interesting to find out where that comes from. And the thesis was an attempt to answer that. And I do think it was a literary device. Mm-hmm. As was, I think, romantic love as a cause for marriage, which starts in the novel before people start insisting on marrying for love in the real world. I know, it is interesting.
Why don't you say a little more about this? I can sense there's great interest in the room.
In the novel, round about before 1760, it's very, very difficult to date something as subtle as people's private lives. You have a society in which marriages are arranged and in which children are given the power of veto, if that. So basically, an upper-class family would pick out a husband for a daughter. For the son, somebody would pick out a wife for him. And you would choose them on the basis of that you thought that they would deal well together, and you would choose them on the basis that financially it suited both families to make an alliance whereby the daughter's dowry portion would be locked with the man, because on marriage, all of everything she owned would become his. So it's a way of organizing, concentrating property into the hands of the rich. That's what marital arrangements were for. The children, both the boy and the girl, would only have the right to say no. And there's a kind of convention that you can only say no twice. You can't keep saying no. You can't choose to be celibate, for instance. Round about 1760, in the novel, you start having people writing quite realistic novels in which people choose their husband in the fiction. Particularly it's about women, so it's mostly women choosing, accepting courtship. And the whole concept of what is attractive in a man starts to become developed in the novel. So it's not just, prior to that date, you have a lot of novels where you follow the life of an adventurous hero. He goes through various trials and tribulations. He's incredibly heroic. At the end, he arrives at some house somewhere, he sees a pretty girl, and she marries him. What happens round about 1760 is people really start to develop the idea that he meets her earlier, that he likes her, that she likes him, that they are parted by circumstances, that he then goes off and is heroic, and then they meet together at the end and they choose each other. And quite often, the reason that parted them was parental disapproval. So you're starting to put into people's minds, or you're starting, authors and readers are starting to think together about that it would be nice to choose somebody on your own account, somebody that you liked, that you were attracted to. This happens, and then subsequently, after about 1760, though it's very about, you have more and more accounts of children saying to their parents, I would like to marry this person. Would you arrange it for me? Is this a suitable person? And then you get the flowering of the London season, which those of you who read folderol historical fictions with lots of romance in it and not much history will be aware that in London and in Bath, the young people are brought together in very carefully controlled environments to make sure that only rich kids get together, because what you don't want is anybody marrying Cinderella. That's the last thing you want, who brings you nothing. So you have these arrangements whereby the rich kids get together and fall in love. And then their parents, of course, subsequently draw up the contracts. But basically what you get is the rise, I think, of the concept of love as a reason for marriage in the novel, slightly before it spreads out into the society, and then it becomes an absolute dominant theme. So that now, if you said in the Western society, I'm going to ask my parents to find someone pretty wealthy who would like me and I would be suitable for, most people would think that was an extraordinary thing to do. And of course, the difficulty which then follows it is that if you marry for love, if love fails you, you then expect to be unmarried. So the rise of divorce comes, I think, straight out of a literary device.
See, now you know the rest of the story. It's absolutely, absolutely fascinating. One person has written that a woman who has been generously described in history and literature and religious text is the Virgin Mary. Mm-hmm. Would this be a topic of interest in terms of
absolute curse? Absolute curse for womanhood. The definition of one woman as wholly good and another woman, Eve, as wholly bad, gives you two stereotypical views which men have tried to impose on women for centuries and indeed still do. How successful a novel would be describing the Virgin Mary as on occasion silly, flighty, in two minds about things, undecisive, a woman, someone who couldn't park. I think I can't see it going well. I can't see it as a successfully, potentially successful novel. But I would never, ever write a novel which showed a woman as only one thing or another. One of the things that is of such interest to me is to accept the fact that we are all mixed characters. You know, we all have, bad sides. We all have faults. We all have flaws. We all fail to do the things we ought to do. And that's when I write about the women I write about, my great joy is picking someone who is supposed to be absolutely wonderful. Margaret Beaufort mm-hmm. was regarded as very nearly a saint. And actually saying, yes, but what was she really like? I don't believe anybody mortal is really like that. And equally, you know, picking someone who is supposed to be really very, very bad, like Margaret of Anjou, saying, actually, what we receive as in the historical record as terrible bad behaviour, ambition, cruelty, savage determination, these are the qualities which a woman shows when she is having to be very, very brave and fight her corner.
Did you, in school or in your family, have women who sort of encouraged you to follow your own course?
Yes. Can you just tell? my mother was a widow, and so I was brought up by a woman on her own who was an extraordinary, courageous, determined, fun person to live with. She was excellent woman. Her mother, my grandmother, was a suffragette, a really poor suffragette, I have to say. She went to one meeting, and my grandfather said to her, if you go again, I will divorce you. And she never went to another meeting. And you go, what sort of struggle is that? I mean, what kind of inheritance is that to leave me? No good at all. Going back further in my family, five generations back, it happens extraordinarily. There is Mary Hayes, who was best friends with Mary Wollstonecraft and was an 18th century feminist. She also was a historian, and she also was a novelist. And really, I think that raises for us all the terrifying spectre that there may be a feminism gene.
That's wonderful. Well, we just can't tell you how pleased we are that you have taken time from what is an incredibly demanding schedule here in the U.S. to be with us tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California. To Dr. Philippa Gregory, one of Britain's best-known historians and novelists and author of the new novel, The Lady of the Rivers, and the new nonfiction anthology, The Women of the Cousins War. This has been an absolute delight to be with you. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Literature series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm pausing so we can edit this out for the radio, but I want to remind all of you that just as we proceed outside, Dr. Gregory has agreed to welcome you and to sign books in the lobby. We will very much appreciate your allowing her to make her way to the lobby before everyone starts to exit. So this will be our royalty. No one will move until Dr. Gregory has exited. I'm Mary Bitterman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.